So my name's Eileen. I'm a junior registrar and I've been working as a junior registrar in obstetrics and gynaecology for about 18 months now.
What initially attracted you to obstetrics?
I was really surprised that I wanted to do obstetrics actually, because well, it was obstetrics and gynaecology. In fact, I was thinking about this earlier today, because I was speaking to a medical student and I remember thinking that before I started medical school, the two things I didn't want to do was sort of elderly care and gynecology, because who would want to look at vaginas all day? That's weird. But then when I was in medical school, just the kind of when we started doing physiology and the basic sciences, and somehow this idea that you've got a baby at the end of it just made it much more exciting than just, yeah, the heart pumps, okay, and does that every day. But this whole that everything about the physiology meant that you were working towards this one crazy event of creating a new person. And then the more I started doing it, and kind of like learning more about it, it's so mixed. You can have, you're kind of you're in the whole caring for people who are really well, and you're being involved in this like amazing experience that they're going through, which is not a sad thing. They are not there because they're sick. But then the flip side is that when it, when it, you get a lot of really kind of acute emergencies, so it becomes very, very exciting. Lots of kind of interesting surgery involved. And then I was always drawn to the fact that, when it goes wrong, it goes horribly wrong, and you have that kind of opportunity to try and make something that's the worst day be not the worst day. So it's got a lot to offer, kind of from a job perspective. It's got a bit of everything. So that's why I kind of wanted to do it from quite early on in my medical training, really.
And during your medical training, what have you been taught about stillbirth?
Gosh, it's quite a long time ago. I'm trying to think back. Not a lot, to be honest. I don't think, certainly not at medical school. I mean, at medical school, I'm sure it was probably mentioned at some stage, but I can't think back to any specific training. But to be honest, a lot of it's all a bit of a blur now. When you come through to, and actually even saying that, when you come through to sort of, choosing to specialise, I can't really think of any specialist training we've ever had on it. It's very much a kind of, it sounds a bit, but learn on the job. You see a lot of, I think, medicine is still kind of an apprenticeship. You see what people do. Sometimes you see and you learn what not to do, and sometimes you see and you learn what to do. But in regards to actually kind of specific training on how to manage stillbirth, I think not very much. And I think even maybe even more actually about miscarriage, because probably because as a more junior member of stuff, so as like an SHO, you are very much involved in early miscarriage. That's kind of as an obstetrician and gynecologist, that's your very much your bread and butter. You're seeing women coming in with very early pregnancy bleeding. You're seeing, so that's when you're very junior, you get taught things a little bit more. I think as you move up in your kind of training, it's very much more kind of assumed that you know things and that you know how to deal with certain situations, rather than necessarily being taught it in that way. So I think most people's kind of experience of stillbirth probably comes from their, experience and seeing it and dealing with it, but also probably stems more from their training in how to manage very early pregnancy losses, because that's really the time that you get taught something about it.
And what was your attitude towards stillbirth before your training?
I think before starting, it wasn't really something you thought about. You kind of, like I said before, you thought about pregnancy being this time and you get this amazing thing at the end, and it's a, and I think maybe you learn more about maternal deaths, because I think if you're an obstetrician, that's, I don't know, maybe that was a kind of bigger draw. It's something you heard about more, that maternal death is something that should never happen, whereas it's more, it seemed more acceptable that there would be some instances where babies would die or they wouldn't, wouldn't make it. But certainly a maternal death is a never event. So you kind of didn't really, consider it as much, or it wasn't really ever touched upon as being something to think about. And that I think because it's not kind of taught or considered, it was always something that you think, oh, that, you know, the day that that's going to happen is going to be a bad day, the day where you have to be the one to break that news or to have that occur. You kind of almost like just don't look at it, and hopefully it won't ever happen. It's not something you really, even talking to, you know, when we have to counsel people on risks in pregnancy, you know, say someone is high risk for whatever reason, whether it's they've got diabetes or they have, you know, very, very obese or whatever, that, you know, we know that factually there is an associated increased risk of stillbirth. I think we still find it quite hard to talk about as clinicians. We kind of will skirt around it. We'll kind of talk about, you know, it can be very dangerous for the baby, or, you know, it could be quite a problematic outcome. You know, people don't like to use the term stillbirth because I think in some cases people feel maybe there's still not sometimes that much you can do to prevent it. And so you worry about scaring people by talking about it, because no one, when they're pregnant, wants to be told there's a risk you could lose your baby. It's just not what anyone wants to hear. So, and unless you can say, you know, this is the risk and this is what we're going to do to stop it, I think people are quite hesitant to kind of bring it up as a subject. So yeah, it's not something we ever really, I think people try and almost think about it as little as possible.
Do you remember the first time you cared for a mother who'd had a stillbirth?
Yeah, I didn't really kind of do much of the caring directly for her, actually. It was quite an unusual event because she had come in for an elective cesarean section, and this is when I was an SHO, actually. And so I was doing all the kind of pre-checks when you go in and talking to her and, you know, getting in. It's usually a bit of a rush. You're kind of trying to get everything, so the list starts on time. And have you got your bloods checked? Yes. Have you done the consent? Yes. And kind of going through. And she just kind of mentioned that she hadn't had any fetal movements since the day before. And I kind of thought, okay, that's not right. And so, you know, I think I went off and I can't remember if I went to go and speak to my consultant or registrar and said, you know, and they said, oh yeah, just pop the scanner on. And so I went to go and scan her. And, you know, I was still not that proficient in using ultrasound. So you kind of put the scan on and go, no, that definitely should be a fetal heart and that definitely isn't moving. And the moment you think, yeah, this is really happening. And you immediately know that, you think, okay, maybe I've got it wrong. And you're looking again, you're looking, no, you definitely haven't got it wrong. But you can't, you know that you can't break that news to that person at that time because it's not appropriate. As an SHO, because you could have made a mistake. You know, there's a possibility. So you have to get someone else to then go and scan. But then kind of, you know, people aren't stupid. People obviously, as much as you try and keep a calm face and keep a sort of like a, everything's okay, you also don't want to lie and say everything's okay because it's not okay. But you can't say exactly what's happening either. So you have to try and, yeah, but I think the mum could immediately tell something was very wrong. But I think she was too scared to ask me what was happening. So I just said that I needed to go and, you know, it was important someone else came and scanned as well. And then, yeah, when someone else came and had to break the news that her baby had died, and, you know, there she was ready to have a cesarean section and had no idea that that could be the outcome. And she actually went on to have a cesarean section for that baby, which is very, very unusual. But given the clinical scenario, that's what happened. So, but it was heartbreaking. It was absolutely heartbreaking. Yeah.
What effect did it have on you, that experience?
I think it's in a weird way, you kind of, I think sometimes in medicine you have to, we're taught to sort of deal with those kind of situations in the sense of like, you know, that's it, you've kind of you've become an obstetrician now, you have dealt with those cases because you have to learn to deal with them. So actually it's a bit like when you first have any sort of surgical complication, you feel like the world's crashing on you, you must be the world's most terrible surgeon, but actually you're taught to deal with it. It's like, no, this is an odds number, you will come across these cases, this is what's going to happen, this is you learning to do the job when you come across cases like this. Because it's, even though you don't have any, you know that you haven't been responsible for it, you still somehow take some of that responsibility with you because you were there when it happened and you had to be the one to sort of be involved in that situation. So somehow it's your fault in a way, like that it's occurred, that you had to be there to make, I don't know, you're involved in that memory. So you have to find a way to sort of make that make sense to you as, you know, this is part of the learning curve and this is, now I'm going to be more of a, I am more of what I do by having that experience. But it's hard because then, you know, I can't remember what was happening that day. In fact, actually thinking back now, I don't think I was actually meant to be doing that theatre list. I think I just happened to be helping out. So then I had to go and do whatever I was supposed to be doing, which I think was clinic or something. But then there's no time to sit and think about it. You can't let yourself get too upset because you're on to the next job and, you know, there's 20 women waiting to have their antenatal appointment and they all need your care, and you can't allow yourself to kind of get bogged down in all that's going on. And what you really want to do is sort of sit and reflect and maybe cry that this poor woman's lost her baby. But actually, if you do, you might miss something in the next person's history, and that could mean that their child's at risk. So you kind of have to compartmentalize and sort of put it in a little bit away that you can kind of, and you do, it does come up occasionally. It might be a case like, in fact, I was thinking about the case the other day because I'm doing revision for exams at the moment, and I was reading one of the guidelines and it was talking about risks and things that can happen, and it was about fetal maternal hemorrhage, and that's what we thought had happened in that particular case. And so immediately that's what I thought of because I'd been to visit the baby afterwards and I remember what the baby looked like, and, you know, and she was very pale and looked like a little doll and she was really beautiful. And so you immediately start thinking of those cases when you're reading about something like that. Which I think is good because then it means that it brings to life more what you're doing. And it means that it doesn't just mean something in a book anymore. It's all real people and real cases. So it kind of becomes alive. But yeah, even though that was years ago, it still has an effect, even though it didn't that day almost. I had to just kind of get on with it. But it will always be the first baby that I came across. So you don't forget them.
You mentioned that you went and visited the baby. Did you go and visit the parents at all again?
No, I didn't actually, because it was very soon. The mum was actually still having her surgery at that point. And I think in that situation, because I'd seen her so briefly and I was quite junior, and I wasn't the one to break the news to her, really. I kind of felt it wasn't necessarily appropriate because I would be going more for me and not for her. I wasn't going there to do something for her, really. And I think that's something we always struggle with, actually. I think when we're caring for women, it's always a really kind of fine line about wanting to make sure that you are giving people the space that they need, but also wanting to make sure that you are showing that you're there if they need something. Like, on particularly on night shifts, I think there's this kind of, because, you know, we tend to start our ward round, you know, we hand over at 8 o'clock in the evening, and we usually do a ward round of the whole ward, and then we may do another one before handover in the morning at 8. And often there's this kind of feeling when you have cases of stillbirth, women who are delivering or have delivered, normally people who have delivered maybe in the recent day, and you're the night team that's coming on, so you've never met these people, they've just gone through something very, very traumatic, and it's always a kind of, actually, you know, their midwife who's with them is working with them one-on-one, and you kind of think, actually, if I was in that situation, would I want this kind of group of people I've never met before coming in to just kind of say, oh yeah, so in the nicest possible way, you've lost your baby, can we do, you know, it sometimes feels like it's not really that appropriate, that actually it's better, but then you do sometimes worry, do they think that we're not coming in because we can't be bothered, or do they think that we're not coming in as part of the ward round because they're not important, or we just, you know, too busy to be bothered. It's hard to know what the right thing to do is, and I think usually when we don't, it's because we think actually there's no clinical need to, and if there's no clinical need to, people often will want to be left alone with people that they know and love and who are going to really be supportive rather than someone they've never met. But it is always that difficult thing of, I think, even lots of cases of deciding, especially when the outcome's been bad, are you going for yourself or are you going for the patient? Because if you're going for yourself, I think that's not really appropriate.
Since that time, you mentioned it was many years ago, have you cared for many other families who've experienced a stillbirth?
I've cared for lots of different families at different stages. I think because of our kind of the way our work works, where we're on shift patterns all the time, you kind of come in and when you're on labour ward, so you're covering the whole of labour ward, there will be women coming in who are either often starting in the induction process if they've had a stillbirth and they're sort of coming in to actually have medicines to help them deliver their babies, or they have they're actively delivering, or they've recently delivered. And so I've been involved in lots of women at different stages throughout that process, or actually having to speak to a woman who's been diagnosed with having just recently diagnosed with having lost her baby. I think maybe it's because it was the first time that it happened, and because I was there at the moment that I knew something was wrong, I think that's the case that always stands out most to me. But there's certainly been lots of other families who, as soon as you start thinking about it, they kind of float up in your kind of visual memory of, oh yes, there was that family and that had happened. Or like one in particular I'm thinking of is, I'd seen them very much after they'd delivered. I think maybe they delivered in the evening and I was in the afternoon or something, and they were just really upset, as you can imagine, and I remember it being difficult because the mother was so distraught, and you know, and just asking why this happened, and you know, having to give an honest answer that we didn't know and that we may never know, and trying to sort of give some comfort and reassurance that, you know, because obviously the immediate thing is that she thought she'd done something wrong and it was her fault, and how do you, yeah, I really remember sort of thinking, how do you convince this person that that is not the case, when you know that if it was you, you would think the same thing, because it's human nature to think that. And as a mother, that is just automatically what you are going to think. And I'm who am I? I'm a stranger who's never met you before. And how can I find the words to tell you that it's not your fault? I think it's so hard because you have to try and not get upset, because that's not your job. And you have to... I'm someone that goes to tears quite quickly. And in that situation, you can't do that. But you kind of want to just sit and cry with them. And I think there's just never going to be the right words to say in that state, or know how to, because everyone's so different as well, and what one person needs to hear is not what another person needs to hear. And we've just met, and you're going through the worst day of your life. And I know that if I say the wrong thing, that could be the thing that you hold on to. And that's always really scary, actually, to think that. And I think especially when people come in and it's, yeah, if people come in and things have just happened, and it's very fresh for them. I think that is often really what people remember, is what people say to them in the first kind of hours or minutes after they've found out that they've lost their baby. And if you say the wrong thing in that moment, that can go on to shape how they view that whole event, which is petrifying. And you know, we work in an area of London where the kind of cultural background is hugely diverse, and you know, religious background, and so to know how to kind of respond to someone trying to read the cues of social cues and body language of what they're looking for and what's going to be the right or the wrong thing to say is really challenging. And I think people genuinely do have the best intentions, but I've seen people say things that you're kind of standing behind them going, oh, why did you, you know, why would you phrase, because you can, I think as being, especially as, that's why, you know, being, when you're an SHO and you're slightly more junior, or even as a, you know, registrar now, if I'm with a consultant, sometimes it's easier to be standing back in the room where you're not the person leading that conversation, because you can have a much broader overview and see people's responses to things. And that's in itself is a very good learning experience. But it's hard, because sometimes you can see someone that you know and respect, and you know they're a good clinician, you know that they care deeply, you know that that, you know, this isn't, that they want to do the right thing, and you see sometimes people say things and the room shifts and you just think, oh, that wasn't the right thing to say, or what, you know, that was a bad way to phrase something. And it's hard because they, that wasn't their intention. And I think it's very, and once you've said it, you can't take it back, you know, even if you've said something and you can see that it wasn't the right thing, there's nothing you can do about that once it's out there. And and it's such a delicate relationship you have with people, which is maybe also another reason why sometimes we shy away from wanting to come in too often. I think probably because as much as we say that, and there is definitely is an element of not wanting to invade people's privacy, I think there is also a fear of, you know, if going in and saying the wrong thing, and a kind of concern that if you, what, yeah, that if you go in and you may cause more harm than good. And I think it's that very tricky balance of knowing the right thing to do when, and when to just kind of leave people to it.
You've talked about the complications because of the differences, and you know, the cultural and religious differences of the of your patients, but are there certain things that you think are helpful or unhelpful to be said in that situation?
I don't know if I've got enough experience with it, like with this area yet, to really kind of to say that I've definitely got things that I would always kind of go to as being something to say. I mean, saying that, I think it's really important just to reiterate that it's not your fault, because I think that is a thing that people carry. And I think it's important to sort of say it out loud, because I think it's something that you know that people are thinking, but you know that people are often don't say it, you know. And I do draw also from your experience with, you know, early pregnancy loss as well. It's something that, you know, people don't say that that's what they're telling themselves, but that's what they're telling themselves. And I think often saying that in the presence of the partner and the, so that it comes out as being something that we know is the issue. And also to the partner, this isn't something you've done either. This is something that has happened that is not anyone's fault. And that, you know, it's, you can't change, you know, you can't, it's not like if you didn't pick up that heavy bag of shopping that this was gonna not happen, or, you know, you can't go back and wish you'd come in sooner, or it's something's happened and there's no one's fault involved. And that you're sorry, and that, you know, that you give condolences, that you recognise that this is the most difficult thing that you're going through, and that we are really sorry it's happening, and we want to do everything we can to try and make it as easy an experience as it possibly can be, but it's not going to be one. I think probably just recognising that this is really hard, and we are going to do our best to help you, but it's just going to be hard. Yeah, I think that's probably the best you can ever say, really.
Do you feel that your training equipped you for those situations?
Probably not. I think there's still, I think there's probably still quite a long way that medicine as a whole, and, you know, my experience for the last, I don't know what, like 6-7 years has been very much obstetrics, but I think, I'm sure it's the same in other parts of medicine, that there's still a long way to go with how we're trained in these kind of sense. I think there still is very much a sort of, you know, as a doctor, you just get on and deal with what's going on. And I think the problem with that is that inevitably rubs off in the way that you deal with patients, because if you deal with yourself and your colleagues in that way, it's very hard not to let to put that onto patients as well. Does that make sense? Because if you can't recognize that if you're not given the space to recognize that this is a really difficult situation for you to deal with and for your colleagues to deal with, I don't think you can then like really have the space to recognize how difficult it is for your patients. I think it's, I think there's still a lot of kind of tendency to just, you just need to, like, that's obstetrics and it's hard and it's difficult and you just need to get on with it. And I think that's not helpful for us, because I think that's automatically reflected on how we deal with our patients. But it's difficult, because how do you balance that? Because I think there does need to be some training into how you can go from having that really emotionally kind of tense and challenging conversation with a woman one minute, and the next minute you may be having to make a life or death, you know, decision about someone else's baby, because if the emergency bell goes and it's a night shift and you are the registrar covering labor ward, that may be the situation. And how to kind of switch your brain between those two things is quite challenging. I mean, you do, but I think part of how you do that is when you're at work, you have to keep the emotional side down a little bit, because otherwise you you don't have the space somehow. And also just to kind of how you keep in the back of your mind being able to give enough time to a family while also constantly reassessing in your head what's going on in 12 different rooms and whether or not you should really be somewhere else because that person's bleeding and that person's having that happening and that baby maybe isn't doing so well. And how do you kind of how do you manage that? Yeah, as I said, I think medicine's still very much a kind of an apprenticeship. You learn by watching other people. But there are certainly areas that we should probably be taught more on, and I think probably stillbirth is one of them. Because there's all the, you know, it's not just the emotional dealing with the family, there's all the paperwork from our point of view, the legality side, how to talk to people about how in-depth investigations they want, you know, whether they want a post-mortem, explaining those things. And yeah, we do get a certain level of training on that, and that is part of things we have to get signed off to progress within our training. But you know, there are certain levels that can be kind of slightly becomes a bit of a tick box exercise. Have you cared for a woman with stillbirth? Tick, yes. Do you know what post-mortem is? Tick, yes. You know, rather than actually looking at it in a little bit more in depth. But it's, you know, the problem is you're fighting for space on a curriculum with lots of other things. Plus the service, you know, training is becoming more and more about service provision. It's about keeping beds moving and patients moving through the door and clinics running. And so the time for training is becoming less and less, unfortunately, and that's across the board. But so things that are so much more delicate, I think, often get pushed to the back of the queue, which is by no means a good thing or an acceptable thing. But yeah, it certainly happens.
You mentioned about post-mortems and further investigations. Can you tell me how you talk to families about those investigations and considering a post-mortem?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I've been very lucky in the sense that I've worked in units that have really, really brilliant specialist midwives in that area. So I've not had to do a huge amount of it actually, because I've had really, really good, been working with really, really good teams, and often the midwives caring for patients, because they spend that much more time with them, have kind of consented for those things. Certainly I often find that it's quite useful to give patients written information before, because like I said, if you're in a busy labour ward and you know that you're going to get possibly called off at any moment, I find it quite useful to have patients read through the written information first so that they can get a general idea, and then we can go through that with them. But also it then means they often will have questions specifically, and they will already have an idea. You can kind of, once someone's read something about it, you can very quite quickly judge who is, you know, very much wants something and who very much doesn't want something, so that you're not then feeling like you're trying to push someone in a certain direction, which is really the last thing you want to be doing. So I find that's quite useful. And I think certainly it's trying to get across that, that, you know, we are happy with whatever level of investigation a parent wants, whether they want nothing or whether they want everything, that is very much up to them. And that we're willing to support them in whatever that decision is. And then trying to kind of, as they go through a little bit more carefully about what those steps are. So whether it's just simply having blood tests to see for mum whether there was any other kind of contributing factors possibly, such as gestational diabetes that has not been previously diagnosed, thyroid problems that were not previously diagnosed, infections. And you've got to balance also making sure that you're not missing a medical problem that also is going to impact mum's health, and you want to make sure that you're looking after mum as an individual as well. And then going on to sort of more, I guess, invasive, whether it's just still doing things like swabs from the baby and swabs from the placenta, through to then possibly taking biopsies from the placenta, possibly from the baby as well, through to a more extensive post-mortem, which, you know, involves a large cut on the baby and actually taking out organs and handling them individually and possibly taking samples from those, and how comfortable the family is with that as an idea. And, you know, making clear that when these things are done, they are done in a way that is dignified, and that the people who are carrying them out are professionals who, you know, do understand that this is someone's baby. And I think it's quite important for parents to know that, you know, these people are trained professionals in what they do. They're not just, you know, they will do this with a sense of gravity. But I think it's also really important to be, you know, for parents to understand the realities of these investigations, that just because we do a post-mortem doesn't mean we necessarily find the answers, that we may well do a post-mortem and all the investigations and find things that are possibly complications, but that may not even be what's led to the stillbirth, and that we may find things that we may find out what has happened, but whether that will impact or influence our ability to prevent it in the future, it may not. So trying to give honest answers, and I think you don't want to create a false sense of hope that, you know, if you go through this procedure, we'll be able to make sure this doesn't happen again. Which is, of course, what we want to be able to say. You know, you so want to just be able to say, this is the worst thing, nothing like this is going to happen to you again, we will make sure we protect you. But unfortunately, it's not the reality, and it's not fair to sort of suppose that is the case. But it's a really hard thing, talking about putting cuts on someone's baby. No one wants that for their child. But at the same time, if that's going to, you know, the reality is, although we can't guarantee we will learn anything, it gives us the best chance. It gives us the best chance to kind of find out as much information, which we hope will help us give you the best care possible if you choose to have children in the future, if you choose to, you know, pursue another pregnancy. We hope to be able to, you know, take the bad things that happen to kind of make the best of the future. But we just don't know.
Is there a sort of an aspect of your role in that situation that you find particularly difficult or particularly rewarding? Or
I think it's always, I don't know if it was an aspect of it, I think it's more just individually, you know, you kind of, you do have it. The most rewarding is when you feel like you've connected with someone and you feel like you have been able to have some sort of positive influence on the experience, that you said the right thing and you presented something in a way that you feel has been useful, or you were able to conduct yourself in a manner with which created the least harm in that situation. And I think we, a lot of the time, you do get a sense for that. You know, the worst or most difficult thing is if you feel you've got it wrong, and you get a sense for that as well. And it's, you know, it's horrible to go home thinking that you've, and it's not even that you've done something wrong, but you've just not quite been able to connect with someone. You've just not quite been able to have the kind of impact you would have hoped on their experience to kind of try and make it a little bit easier. And that's, you know, that's going to happen. We're all different people, personality wise, and what, you know, what we need from people is very, very different. So I think that's probably the kind of highs and the lows of it. I think it's always quite hard going through paperwork, I find, because a lot of it feels so impersonal. You know, you want to, like you say, you want to be able to sit down with someone and just be like, this is terrible, I'm so sorry, and kind of and having to sit there and trawl through a load of paperwork with them, and, you know, this is this blood test and this is this blood test and this is what we're doing for this reason, you can tell it's like it's the last thing anyone who's in that situation really wants to have to go through, and sign loads of documents and kind of go through the legalities of things. It's just not, it's very hard to make that a therapeutic process. People are tired, you know, they're emotionally exhausted, they're often physically exhausted, they just want to go home. And so, you know, that is not really an easy, it's the kind of, it's often the last thing, but I find that often the most difficult to kind of actually kind of trudge through, really.
How helpful, I mean, you've touched on this a little bit, but how helpful do you think it is to have an emotional response in situations like this?
You know, I really don't know. I really don't know, because, yeah, and maybe that would be something that would be useful for us to know as doctors, because we don't really get told that. I mean, you know, as I say, I'm someone that goes, I cry easily. I mean, I cry at adverts. You know, I will give and. If I let myself quite easily get upset, and you think, oh, is this, if I, you know, you're trying to hold back tears sometimes, and you kind of get yourself together, this is not about you. Because I think we are taught, we're not taught, but you, that it's just not professional. And actually that's not your role to be doing at that time, especially if it's, I think it's different if it's, say, someone that you have formed a relationship with. Maybe it's someone that you've seen in clinic over many weeks, and you know that person, you've kind of seen them, you've joked with them, you, and I think certainly then there's no way if I had one of my patients that I've had built that relationship with, who came in all trying on my part, is not going to be able to not be emotional. But I think when it's someone that you've never met before, which is most often the situation, unfortunately, when these horrible things happen, it's often a complete stranger. The feeling we get, or at least I think the general feeling, is that it's kind of not appropriate. But I don't know. I mean, maybe it would be. Maybe people would find it comforting to know that the people looking after them care to that extent. And we do, you know, even if, I'm just immediately thinking about sort of, you know, being in handover room, and there's often, because often people will be diagnosed with a stillbirth, and then they will go home, and then they will come back to have their induction process. And so we've often got on the board that someone's coming in on the Saturday or the Wednesday or whatever. And there's always a kind of, you know, all this, you see it, the staff like, oh, isn't that so sad? Oh, isn't that poor lady? You know, people do kind of, you know, we're not even talking about it, but it was just automatic. If someone sees that on the board, it's, people feel for that person. They may never meet them, they may have never met them, but they do care. And they do, you know, it's always, if you're on a ward round and there's someone, it's always like, oh, isn't it awful? Isn't it so sad? And we see them lots, but every time we care, because, you know, every time we know that that's our job, we spend all of our lives trying to have well mums and well babies. You know, you can't do this job where, you know, you spend evenings and weekends and however long kind of studying and training if you don't care. It's just that maybe sometimes we don't always feel it's appropriate or know how to show that. And it can seem like it's, people are kind of, I don't know, dead into it because we do it all the time. But actually, you couldn't do the job if you didn't care. It's just too hard. It's just too much hard work. If you didn't give a crap, it would, there are a lot of easier jobs to do. So that's why we do it.
So how do you separate that personal and professional response? How do you do that?
I don't know. I think there's a time when you kind of, sometimes you sometimes it's important not to too much. Certainly if it's an emergency, then that becomes very different. You kind of, everyone has their own kind of, I think, personally become in an emergency. And I've certainly become quite, I don't say calm, because it's probably maybe a little bit, probably not as calm as I think I'm. But, you know, I'm kind of like, I slow down and that's it, you go into sort of autopilot in a way. But I like to keep the personal just below the surface, because I think that's what makes it enjoyable for me. So it's that very, very difficult balance of bubbling the personal with what you're, it's a fine balance. And sometimes it may become, you don't get the balance right. And certainly, you know, I've had patients that I've cried with and I've thought, actually, was that appropriate? I'm not sure it was. Maybe I should have been a bit more professional. But certainly, you know, I talk to friends. You know, I have, most of my friends aren't medical. I don't really have a lot of kind of doctor friends. And so, you know, I think in that way it's easier to talk on a more personal level about cases that you've had that are difficult, because they see the humanity in it a lot easier than if you're talking about those cases with someone who's also a professional. You kind of immediately share the professional side of things. But yeah, I can talk to my friends who are, you know, work in the arts or in journalism or whatever they do, and they will automatically be like, wow, that's so terrible. Or that's, you know, you can talk about the more human side of it a lot easier. And I think I find that very useful to be able to have that, those friends to go to talk about those things, and to gain, to kind of keep your humanity in it and to gain that perspective so you don't lose that. But I think, you know, at least that's why I love people, and people are so interesting and individual, and you get such an amazing kind of insight into all these different people's lives by doing the job that I do, that I definitely feel like keeping that kind of personal relationship very close is what makes it so much more rewarding and enjoyable. And yes, sometimes you have to push it aside to do your job properly, but you need to keep bringing it back to kind of make the experience fulfilling and worthwhile. But whether I get the balance horse right, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
And if you feel emotional at work, what support is available to you as a clinician?
I think that depends very much on where you're working, what your department dynamic is like. I mean, I've had, you know, bad cases where I've immediately gone and I know the person I'm looking for. I'm looking for that one friend, that consultant, and I grab them and take them into the broom cupboard and cry my eyes out, or, you know, and they are there to sort of say, it's fine, it's going to be okay, and, you know, talk you down and talk you through what's happened or what's going on. And, you know, there's, you know, yes, technically we have our educational supervisor and this supervisor, and there is a man, you know, there is a structured system so that if you had a serious problem, there are people to talk to. But I think the reality is, like, whenever you work in anywhere, you have people that you build specific relationships with, and those are the people you go to kind of run through things. And it's your colleagues that, you know, maybe your junior colleagues or your mid, you know, you're working in parallel colleagues, but they're the people that you build specific personal relationships with that you tend to go to really when you have kind of emotional days or days that you find difficult to deal with. I think there's still not, there still probably isn't as much kind of holistic care for ourselves. I have a friend who worked in kind of the charity sector, dealing with quite difficult situations with, she was dealing with women who'd been exploited, and you know, they had so much more kind of about having, teaching each other about self-care and, you know, group talks about talking about cases they were dealing with, to sort of share those experiences. And it was great because I learned a lot from her about that and the importance of this idea of self-care. Sorry, what's that? I've never heard of it before. But actually, it is so important. And I think probably that's not in our curriculum, that's not in our vocabulary. And I think we probably do need a lot more of that to help us kind of deal with, you know, whether it's something as catastrophic as someone losing their baby or simply, you know, making a bit of a mistake that actually no harm came from it, but, you know, we take it seriously and we beat ourselves up about them. So probably do need to learn to rely less on this kind of structure of this is your supervisor and that's who you go to, and just a more generalized way of how to kind of deal with the kind of fallout from working in a world that is so full of highs and lows.
In terms of the different places that you've worked, can you tell me a little bit about the facilities that you've seen at hospitals for families who are going through a stillbirth?
So I think there is, again, it's very dependent on where you are, unfortunately, and some places are much more kind of better designed. And I think the hospital I'm working at the moment, their maternity unit has been designed quite recently, and I think people have thought a lot more about how to care for women who've gone through something traumatic like a stillbirth. And so, for instance, in this particular department, the most departments will have a particular room that they try and have further away from the rest of the kind of the quieter end of the labour ward, where we would try and care for women who've gone through something like stillbirth, so that they're not having to be constantly exposed to sort of sounds of labour and sounds of babies and things. But this particular unit even has a separate entrance to the labour ward, actually, to the area where that room is, so that you know family and the partners doesn't have to continuously come through the main entrance, which I think is really a nice way of managing it. And there is often an area, most rooms will have an area close by or just adjacent to the room that's kind of dedicated for this purpose, that will be a place where the baby, once it's born, can be stored and looked, and so that parents can have access to kind of be close to the baby if they want to see the baby if they want to, but that there's a separate area so that maybe if they're not wanting to do that all the time, that's feasible. Having a specialist midwife, I think, is really, really important, because, you know, as I say, we do shift work and people come and go, so just having that one port of call, that person that you know knows what you're going through and understands the whole system and is, you know, going to check your bloods for you and keep all your paperwork together, and is really, really important. I think I've never worked somewhere that hasn't had that, but I find it, I don't know how a unit would be able to cope with not having someone that's dedicated to that role, because it's such an important role. But I think those are the main sort of facilities that are really available. And, you know, in some places, so it's always very difficult. Sometimes if it's, you know, if someone's picked up that their baby has passed away on an ultrasound scan, finding a space to be able to speak to them, because often they're brought to, you know, as a doctor, I'm often asked to see someone in the maternity, what's equivalent to what we call the maternity day unit, which is often in the place where women come to have, if they're unwell or to have certain checks throughout their pregnancy. And it just feels like the most inappropriate place to see someone in that situation, because it's busy and there's lots of people around, and trying to find a quiet space in a hospital is just like, you know, it's as rare as hen's teeth. So there are some, again, I think as hospitals modernise, we are trying to, we're understanding the importance of having those spaces available. So a hospital I recently worked at, actually their antenatal clinic had just been slightly redesigned, and they had included a kind of an extra room that's not a consultation room, but it's a quiet room that can be used for that purpose. And actually, I used it for that purpose before I left. And I remember thinking, yes, this is really important that we have this room here. And it had some sunlight in it, and it wasn't kind of, you know, completely a dark space that, you know, is sort of huddled away. Because you also don't want to feel like you're being hidden away somewhere, away from everyone else, that, you know, you need a space that still is light and has kind of, you know, circulating air. You're not kind of pushed away in the back of the kind of labour ward where no one can see you. So it's a sort of balance between those two things of not being forced to being exposed to everything else that's going on and sort of having that rubbed in your face, but at the same time not feeling like you're kind of hidden away in the back somewhere as well. And again, it's how do you strike that balance in the realities of the NHS is tough. And I'm sure we don't get it right most of the time, but, you know, certainly I think it's a shift to try and be more aware of it.
How much do you talk with your colleagues about stillbirth?
Not a lot. I think it's everyone's, it's all our worst nightmare, because, you know, when you talk about, you know, talk about earlier about women and sort of, you know, saying it's trying to convince someone that's not your fault, you know, we feel that as well. And it's that constant in the back of your mind, like, whether you're in, you know, when you're in antenatal clinic, and I had, like, you know, clinic last week where between me and one other person we saw 40 patients in like 3 hours, and you're thinking, have I missed something? What if I've missed something really important? What if I've missed something that's then going to lead to that person losing their baby? You know, it haunts you. You go home at night and think, did I put that form in? Did that scan form go in? Have I, you know, what if I haven't? What if that's the, you know, it does kind of, it's that constant, you know, I think people often at work will have something that is their kind of bottom line, that if it goes wrong, this is what's going to happen. And when your bottom line is if you do something wrong, the baby might die, it's quite a big bottom line to have. And I think people, you can't really think about it all the time. And the reality is that, you know, there are lots of safety checks in a hospital. And you know, I'm sure that if people are very good at looking after their own health most of the time, and if you didn't get a scan that you were supposed to get, especially people who are pregnant, they're pretty motivated in saying, oh, I didn't get that scan I was supposed to get, and it will happen. But I think it's not something that we talk about that much. And I think partly also because we've moved much more to working in shifts now. So we don't, it's not the old system where, you know, it used to be that you would work with a consultant and you would do that consultant's antenatal clinic and you would do that consultant's ward round and you would do that consultant. So you had a much clearer cohort of patients that you looked after. Whereas now, you know, I will be doing one consultant's clinic one day and then the ward round, and then it's much more, you don't see that same continuity of care. So there's not the same link up of saying that, and you don't work in small teams as much anymore. So it's not so kind of this patient that you've looked after, this has ended up happening to them, and then you as a team reflect back on that. I think when they happen, and when you are involved in the care of those patients, then yes, you do talk to your colleagues, I think, who are involved in that case, or the midwives who you're working with who are involved in that case. You do talk about it then, but it's more as an immediate event in relation to those patients rather than necessarily kind of in general. And there are cases, you know, as an obstetrician, the absolute worst thing that can happen, I think, probably apart from a maternal death, is an intrapartum death. So if you are looking after a woman in labour and her baby dies in labour, that is kind of ground zero of things that are not supposed to happen. So if ever, and luckily it happens very rarely, but if ever you are involved, or you not even involved, you know, if you, I'm thinking about a case that I know of that happened reasonably recently, and it is a case that, you know, that kind of case you do talk about with your colleagues, because you want to learn from that case. You want to talk about what went wrong. Is there something we could have done? Is it just something that we couldn't have predicted? How could we have done it differently? If I was in that situation, what could I have done differently? So I think those kind of cases we do talk about more. But I think as a generality, and certainly with how we feel about stillbirth or how you cope with stillbirth, is not something that is really discussed between colleagues, no.
Have you sort of experienced, I mean, what sort of attitudes, I mean, maybe they're not discussed, but what sort of attitudes towards stillbirth have you heard expressed by colleagues or encountered?
I mean, I think they are kind of seen as, I think probably much more so, like I was saying about maternal deaths being this thing that should never happen and can never happen. I think it's not quite the same attitude to stillbirths. I think there is much more of an attitude of, this is something that is terrible, but sometimes it's just one of those things. And I don't know if that's something that should shift. I think it's something to do with the frequency, in the sense that it is something that's more common. You know, and that's something certainly that people don't talk about, the fact that it's actually something that, you know, it is a reasonably common thing. So I think, yeah, it's, and because vast majority of them we never find a reason for, it becomes that much more difficult to kind of know how to, because when you don't know what causes them from a medical point of view, it's hard to get kind of, how do you think about it in any other way apart from it's a really sad thing that sometimes happens, because you don't know what else to do to prevent it or to change it. And that, you know, there are certain, you know, we know that, you know, small for gestational age baby and uterine growth restriction is one of the major kind of factors, and so we're always kind of looking out for that, and that's something that we can actively do. And obviously all the other things that we get concerned about. But other than that, I think people just generally think of it as this just terrible thing that happens sometimes, that we don't really know how to stop or how to kind of make not happen. And so we just have to do the best we can to deal with, to look after women. And we are medics, so we very much want to try and get to the bottom of it and try and stop it happening again, because that's our job. That's what we, you know, that's what we're supposed to, you know, we're supposed to make sure this doesn't happen. And then when it does, that's kind of, I think, the thing we want to do is find out how we can stop it happening in the future, because that's why else are we here? You know, there's no point of us being here if we can't stop stillbirth happening. But in the same vein, we know that we can't stop it always. So it's a kind of a bit of a kind of double. But I don't think I've ever heard, I've certainly never come across any, you know, views on it that have surprised me, or kind of I've gone, oh, that's a very odd way to respond. I think there is certainly just a very wholesale, whatever, you know, I've worked with colleagues from all different kinds of backgrounds and cultures, and, you know, and whether or not people are from a culture where they express emotion more or less, it's just a sad thing. And a thing that people wish didn't happen. And I think that's just universal with anyone that works in this kind of field. I've never heard anyone express anything apart from that.
With regard to sort of practical advice and support to mothers following a stillbirth, what sort of practical advice and support do you give?
I think for me, this is not something that I've been quite so involved in because, as I say, specialist midwives and also kind of consultants, because they do the kind of 6 weekly, it's normally around 6 weeks that you have a follow-up appointment who then go on to give, because quite often, you know, when you are in the very acute phase, when you've just left hospital, maybe 24 hours after you've, you know, delivered, you're not really in a place where you're kind of taking on huge amounts of information. So our kind of advice generally at that point is much more saying, look, we are here. If you need us, please contact us. You know, we are willing, and that's what we want, to be here for you if you feel you need us. And certainly from a kind of medical perspective, sort of saying, you know, if you start to feel unwell, if you start to have any heavy bleeding, particularly kind of any signs of infection, so if you start getting kind of worsening abdominal pain, you're feeling that your bleeding is increasing in heaviness rather than settling down, which is what it should be doing, or any offensive discharge, any high temperatures, then, you know, please come back and see us immediately, because obviously one of the risk factors for stillbirth is infection, and that may not present itself until slightly after. So certainly kind of just giving that kind of basic medical advice of when to come and see us. But I think it's more when you see a consultant at the kind of follow-up appointment, where they'll be able to sort of sit down a little bit more away from the acute event and kind of give more advice on what we can do to sort of try and minimise the risks long term. And that will obviously be drawing part on what your results have been, and, you know, and without judgment and without placing blame, talking about just general health measures that hopefully could make a difference. You know, if you smoke, trying to, you know, not smoke in a future pregnancy. We're not saying that was why this had happened, but, you know, anything we can do to try and minimise the risks, kind of those sorts of things. Then, and looking at your individual kind of risk factors, and I guess also then talking about decisions to, if you do want to get pregnant in the future, and when's the right time and when's not the right time. And I think that's probably something that is quite important to women to kind of, they worry about, and that we also know that there's quite a kind of discordance among partners for that, in the sense that women tend to have more kind of psychological, are more prone to having a difficult sort of response or having increased anxiety if they get pregnant very soon, whereas men are more prone to have a much more anxiety if it takes a long time to get pregnant. So we know that there is often this kind of difference in the way that parents respond to kind of that decision to have another pregnancy. So kind of addressing all of those things, and also trying to catch up on how people are, yeah, how people are coping, and whether trying to identify, you know, the people who are coping and dealing with something that's really traumatic and difficult, and so obviously grieving and you know, having a very difficult time, but differentiating that from people who are not coping, and who are things are moving more into a kind of area where it's becoming more problematic, and they're having a kind of more a kind of medicalized kind of depression response, and so being able to identify those people and offer them the appropriate help. And that may not be mum, that could be the dad, you know, dad, or that could be children, or that could be grandparents or people in the immediate family, but making sure that, you know, we try and kind of be there to sort of help identify that and recognize that's going on. But that's not something that I have really been involved in, because I don't tend to see people at that later stage.
You've mentioned dads. What about dads in this situation?
Oh, I always feel for dads in general, I think, actually, in obstetrics, because I think it's a really hard really, really hard thing to, I mean, we don't like to focus too much on, I think because we're quite kind of, you know, generally you're pretty feminist if you work in obstetrics, you care about women, and, you know, because of the kind of historical patriarchy that's taken place, and, you know, men being able to sort of make decisions about women's care, we're very we jump very quickly if we think that there's a situation where a partner is kind of trying to impose his desire on a woman, and this can be in all forms of obstetrics. We very much want to represent and be caring for the woman as a patient, but at the same time we do recognize that, you know, that they are going through this as a couple, and that the father in all stages of obstetrics is involved and is affected. And definitely when it comes to losing your baby, it's absolutely heartbreaking to see, because he's having his own experience of losing his child, but he's also seeing his partner go through something that he can't protect her from. And sometimes people get angry, and we know that, and that's okay. It's difficult because sometimes it's not okay. And, you know, if you're making threats to people or staff, and we do know why, but you also have to be, there has to be a line there. But it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to see someone be so pained for themselves, but so pained for someone else at the same time. It's really hard to know how to kind of involve them and make them part of the kind of process sometimes. And I think we do try, and certainly I always try and make sure that you are speaking to both people, you know, and explaining to both people what's going on, that it's not just you're trying to push out the father from that experience. They need to be taken in, and I think as much as possible to sort of help them be a couple in that situation, and help them be, give each other support rather than separating them. But yeah, it's really difficult, because also, you know, men are not, I think in our society, men are not given space to grieve, and, you know, how men are taught that you have to be strong, and you are, and I think a lot of men do feel like that, that they need to be there, they need to be the strong one for their partner who's kind of possibly falling apart, and I think that puts an incredible amount of strain on them, and trying to create a space where it's okay for them to cry, and it's okay for them to be openly upset, because hospital is a public space, it's a, you know, we are, and, you know, we're all women as well, and I think that's quite hard for a man to, within our society, to be that vulnerable openly with strangers. And I think there's so much feeling of a loss of control when you are in that kind of situation where, you know, a traumatic experience like that. And I think especially for a partner who's, you know, often within our society taught that his role is to protect his partner and protect his child, and that's all just been stripped from him, and he doesn't have that anymore, and he's in a space where he probably doesn't feel comfortable, and I think it's incredibly hard for him to know how to navigate that. And again, what do you say? How do you make that easier? It's very, very challenging, but I think hopefully just by at least recognizing that it's happening, you can start to open up a space for him to be able to be in. And I think trying to be understanding and recognizing that when people are upset, they often express that in ways that are challenging. You know, like I said before, people do get angry, and or just difficult. You know, people can behave quite difficult manner, which is fine. And actually, you know, sometimes it's when you've had a hard day and you have to just remind yourself, this is not about you, this is not about your team or your hospital that you think overall does a good job. This is about them and their experience, and that's okay. But yeah, it's not easy for either partner.
You touched earlier on sort of subsequent pregnancies. What advice, if any, do you give to parents about getting pregnant again?
As I said, so this is not something that I would kind of have been so involved in, the sense that I sit down and kind of give people advice, but certainly, you know, we would always say that it's an individual choice about when you choose to have another baby, or if you choose to try for another baby. And that's, you know, that's certainly an important thing, is just because you don't have to. And I think it has to be pressed upon that it's individual, and the only person who's going to know if and when it's the right time is you. We certainly, you know, there is some data out there that it is more, you're more at risk of having a kind of you're more at risk of having a kind of more depression or anxiety if you get pregnant within 12 months of having had a stillbirth. That is a kind of, can be quite emotionally taxing for a woman. It's not quite the same for if you're the partner in that situation. But, you know, studies are based on averages, and people are not averages, people are individuals. So I think if you strongly feel that you want to, then that's fine. And, you know, I think people need to be aware that, you know, there are certain things that we would try and, you know, inform people of, such as the fact that, you know, when you're not breastfeeding and you're not lactating, your periods can come back quite soon after you've had a stillbirth. And so it is possible for you to get pregnant before your next period. So it's quite important that people understand that, so that if it's not something they're planning, that they are, you know, they're taking precautions and using contraceptives, because I think probably one of the things people don't want to do is have an unplanned pregnancy probably very soon after something as traumatic as that. So again, it's just about educating and touching on subjects that probably feel a little bit almost quite inappropriate to talk about so soon after. But kind of making people aware of things like that. And also just, I think probably the best thing is just, you know, being open and honest with your partner about it, and having that discussion about when is going to be right for you as a family, and, you know, how you both feel about it. Because, as I say, we do know that there is this slight disconnect between the kind of, you know, these are all very, very much generalizations, but they're kind of generalizations based on research that men tend to feel more anxiety if you don't have children sooner, whereas women tend to feel more anxiety if you do have children sooner. So the best thing to do is talk about that, because we know that that is an issue, and it's not just something that probably you as an individual couple are going through. It's something that is kind of felt across the board, and if you can kind of be made aware of that, it kind of takes the pressure off a little bit. But there's just never a right or wrong thing to do. And I think that's the most important thing to know.
Do Do you sort of have any other reflections or insights about the time that you spent working with parents who've experienced stillbirth?
I think just that, you always really hope that you're able to get across how much you are sorry that this has happened, and how much you wish it hadn't. And I think when, you know, things go wrong and you get an outcome that obviously is not what anyone expects, it's so challenging, and you know, and there's this kind of waves of emotion going on, and you know, there's this difficulty of trying to navigate that, to kind of provide clinical care and to provide a good clinical service, and to carry that on and say, okay, what are the risks clinically in this situation? What are the medical things that could be going wrong? Has the mum got a severe infection that we've not put, you know, kind of, we need to do the legalities. We need to make sure that all this paperwork is done correctly because it's legal. We need to make sure that the bloods are done correctly and we don't miss something, that the mum gets her cabergoline if that's what she wants before she leaves, to stop her having lactation so she doesn't continue to produce breast milk. You know, all these kind of things that are that's your job really, is to make sure those things happen. But that's kind of the nuts and bolts of what you have to do to do your job. But then above and beyond that is this whole other thing, which is how you care for someone who has gone through the worst thing they've ever gone through in their life, or will probably ever go through. And it's a hard job to work out how you fit that all together and individualize that for the individual circumstance and the individual person. And I think we don't always get it right, but I think you can take solace that even if we're not necessarily showing it, we do really care. And it may be that it's not till we go home and have a very large gin and tonic later on that we really allow ourselves to think about how much we care about it. But we really do. And if we feel like we've done a bad job, there's unlikely anyone who's going to kind of feel as bad about it as we have. And we all make mistakes. And yeah, we're not always perfect, but I've certainly never met someone who works in this job who doesn't really care about the babies and mothers and dads that they look after.